morning, I thought of about 20 stories I wanted to tell on myself vis-a-vis this reading. I realized that would get very quickly very boring. Very boring very quickly. But I did have a thought when we were in the minister's room just before service of the story of Mahatma Gandhi, who was there one point when a mother brought her son to him and said, "You have to tell him to quit eating so much candy." And Mahatma Gandhi thought for a little while, and then he said, "Bring him back in a week." And so the mother left and brought him back in a week, and Mahatma Gandhi looked at the little boy and said, "You have to quit eating candy." And the mother said, "Well, thank you, oh great one, for saying that, but why didn't you just tell him that last week?" And he said, "First, I myself had to quit eating candy." When I tell you that because the reading this morning is really so profound. I might say that about every reading every week, and I think I often do as I'm thinking about them, either as one of our other ministers are speaking or as I'm preparing for a sermon. But it is just particularly true with the Beatitudes, and particularly with this first Beatitude, that really says we have to give up all aspects of our ego and remember that we are nothing but the divine. And that story came to me when I was thinking, I'm going to come out and speak about how we give up our whole ego. But I was saved by remembering that Swami Kriyananda has said to us many times, Swami Kriyananda, who founded Ananda, for those of you who are new, has said to us many times that we should always consider ourselves in light of our aspirations. So it lets us off a lot of hooks. Thus, I can come out and give a little talk on this beatitude. Because I was born and raised in a Jewish family and actually took that very seriously, I came in as a seeker and I came in as a young Jewish person, so I studied all there was to know about Judaism. I taught there, and I will say I did and still do in some ways feel very attuned to whatever that is. For me, it feels almost cultural rather than religious, because there was very little about the religion as it was taught to me ultimately that I could really relate to. But nonetheless, I was very drawn there. But what happens when you were born and raised Jewish, and you were born 64 years ago, is that there's a strong thread of anti-Christ teaching that is just handed to you over and over again. I think I've said this up here before. I've never completely understood it. As soon as I realized that that was not my path, that was not going to help me find, I was not finding it to be inspiring, is really the word. I began to realize how much of what I had been hearing, so much in my life that I didn't really agree with. And I didn't know how much I didn't agree with all of the negative teaching around Christ until I came to Ananda, because Paramahansa Yogananda and Swami Kriyananda and Asha and many of the other ministers who have been on this path for 40, 50, 60 some years in the case of Swamiji have such an extraordinary way of sharing with us Christ's teaching that very quickly I became aware I knew I was hearing the truth, and I had to go back and let go of so much of what I had learned and carried for all of those years. It just resonated with me. And while I feel a strong connection now, many years later, with all of these masters that are behind me, I just have a particular love in my heart for Jesus. It's an interesting thing for a Jewish woman to have come to, but it's the truth. But still, I don't understand the Bible necessarily the way people do, other disciples, other devotees I hear them speak, who were born and raised in various Christian traditions. So I had to read a little bit about what the Beatitudes are. I knew that they are, the eight of them, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And when I said it's so profound, I mean because Jesus, and it says this in the Bible, actually went up on the mountain and he called his disciples to him. And many have interpreted that as meaning he called his 12 disciples to him. Well, it's very humbling to think that these are the teachings, what we're reading today, are the teachings that he knew would be understood by his disciples only, by those 12 disciples. It reminded me of, Swami tells us all the time that Yogananda would be out and about and teaching continuously. And there was a lot of teaching that he would share in various places. But that when he was with the monks of Self-Realization Fellowship, when he was with his closest disciples, all he ever wanted to talk about or teach them was about attunement, one of the most important qualities on any spiritual path or in any religion. To know the true teachings, one has to attune themselves to the vibration of the teacher and perceive the truth in those teachings. The greatest teachings, certainly the teachings that we're talking about, the way it's presented here, where we read something from the Bible, then we read a very similar reading from the Gita, which just speaks to the fact that there are teachings that underlie every great religion. That's why we call this a spiritual path and not a religion. Because all of you are sitting out there, you've all come here from many different religions. But we're here because we know we're hearing the truth. And now we're hearing these great truths that Jesus called his disciples to him, the way Master would only speak about attunement, or even more than that, he would often just be with his monks in silence, really wanting to teach them the great subtlety of how one attunes oneself to one's teacher. So here we have the Beatitudes, which is how Jesus opened his Sermon on the Mount to his disciples. When I was looking this up and just reading a little bit about the Beatitudes, not necessarily this beatitude, because very quickly I found when I wanted to read, the teachings became further and further away from how I felt it to be true. In other words, there were just people writing things about the Beatitudes. Perhaps they had a true experience of Jesus, or perhaps they hadn't, but it didn't feel as resonant with me. So I just read a little bit about the Beatitudes. And I found this description that I wanted to read to you rather than have to try and memorize it, that was written by St. Gregory, who lived in Cappadocia in the late 300s, and who was thought to be one of the first people, or at least people who wrote about it or taught about the Beatitudes, who contemplated them. The first mystic or saint who contemplated the Beatitudes. And he described a beatitude as a possession of all things held to be good, from which nothing is absent that a good desire may want. Perhaps the meaning of beatitude may become clear to us, he said, if it is compared with its opposite. Now the opposite of beatitude is misery. Misery means being afflicted unwillingly with painful sufferings. When I read that, I realized that what I was reading really was the definition of what we call Dharma. Dharma means that which is good, not which we think is good or not that's just good for ourselves, but some action, some thought, a teaching that in essence, is good for all of the world for all time, that it brings more goodness. It wants for nothing that would have a good thought, just the way St. Gregory described a beatitude. Beatitude comes from a Latin word that means blessed. And of course, all of the beatitudes start that way, as did ours. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And the teaching that underlies these beatitudes are really Dharmic teachings. And it just pointed out to me again, as I read his commentaries on them, how similar true teachings are. How none of the great teachers, great spiritual teachers, never mind all of the thousands of others who have perceived the truth. And I always say this, I think, in every talk I give, so I'm aware that I've said it here before, ever vary. They don't argue with each other, but even more than that, they come to the same truth, just like Jesus did, just like St. Gregory did, just like Krishna, when he's teaching to Arjuna, would have spoken about Dharma. So what is behind this teaching? What is behind this teaching is really the essence of what I'll call true Christianity. The essence of what Christ really came to teach, which was about love. It was about humility. It was not, as he came in time to speak to the Jewish people, the same things that Moses had brought down with the Ten Commandments from another mountain, which were all of the thou shalt nots. It was not presented to the people in a negative way. He said, I am here to teach you about an inner transformation. This is what we would do were we all to want to know God. And basically, what he says in this beatitude is give up your ego. Let go of all thoughts of I, me, mine. They will not serve you. He said, in essence, what Yogananda and Swamiji have said to us over and over in every book Swamiji writes. When I was looking up ego, so I thought, I'll look in the index of some of Swamiji's books yesterday to find ego. It was so silly of me, particularly in the Gita, and in his interpretation of the Gita. There's 1,000 references, because all of the true teachings, whether it was his commentaries on the Bible, whether it was his commentaries on the Gita, whether it was in Sadhu Beware, which I'll speak a little bit about later, the essence of self-realization, all of these extraordinary books, really, the teaching is let go of your ego. Very simply said. In fact, very simple to say, I should say. And in fact, he goes so far, as does Yogananda, as did Jesus, to say that the purpose of this life, the only purpose of life, this is quoting all of these great teachers, the only purpose in life is to let go of the hold that the ego has on the soul. That's extraordinary to hear that. That says to all of us who were brought into this church for some reason, whatever it is that drew each of us here, and many of you, of course, who I know, draws us here over and over, we are doing that because we are trying to get closer and closer and closer to our true selves. We have walked onto a path that is called a path of self-realization. It's not a path about getting to know more and more and more about our little selves, about our egocentric selves. It's a path that says, I want to know my true self. So everybody in this room this morning has to have their ears perk up when these great teachers say the only purpose in life is to free ourselves from the hold that the ego has on the soul. Swamiji says in one of his books, every other teaching on every spiritual path, he uses the word, is subservient to that truth. There's nothing else. That's what every teaching, every reading, everything is heading right to that point. Well, that's not so easy to do. We're all pretty attached to our egos. We're attached to it in obvious ways, which are the easier ways to begin to work on letting go of the hold it has on our soul. And then there are these myriad of ways, millions of ways, that we're attached that don't even look so bad. We want to do good things. We think we know what's best for our children. We want to do good work wherever we go to work. But very often, unbeknownst to us, we are continuously talking about I, me, mine. I need to do this. I need to do that. I need to help my children. I need to get them into a good school. I need to work harder. I need to do a good presentation. Oh, it gets so boring. I keep thinking of the word that Master used when he talked about the boring monotony of it all. Every once in a while, you just want to say, it's enough about me. You begin to feel your smallness in all of this. But these are very, very subtle and hard teachings. That is why Swamiji said, define yourself in terms of your aspirations. Otherwise, we would all be so depressed. The path would look so impossibly difficult. I was just up at Spiritual Renewal Week, as I know some of you were, a few weeks ago. It was so compelling up there. It was so inspiring, so uplifting. I think so much of what I heard all of those speakers say will inform every talk that I give for a very long time to come. But over and over from the speakers, several times I would say, three or four times, they kept going back to Patanjali and his teachings about yoga. Patanjali was really the first and remains the foremost teacher on the study of yoga. And in fact, the first aphorism, Patanjali's first aphorism is, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga. And so many of the speakers were introducing that because they went on to say, each in their own way, it takes a very long time, a very long time, to even want to transform ourselves, to even want to step out of delusion. And if we're honest with ourselves, we know that. I was telling a story recently about when I was in my 30s, and I was married to a man who I was married to for a very long time. We were a very dynamic couple. We were both doctors. We loved to dance. He played the drums. We were teachers in the area. We rode motorcycles. It was this very sort of passionate life. We were having fun. We were loving our life. And I remember I used to look at him all the time and say, but we were on a path. And we were at Ananda for many years. Then, as I've mentioned to you, I went on a different path for 9 years with another teacher and then came back to Ananda. So I've been studying spiritual teachings for a long time. But for many years, I used to say to him, I don't get it. Why don't people want to come back again? I just couldn't get it. To me, coming back again and getting to do that all over at that point was the greatest thing I could think about. Now, I've come quite a ways, even in the next 30 years. 30 years is nothing, really. When I say it takes a long time to even want to step out of delusion, if we even just look at this lifetime so we can wrap our minds around it, because it's very hard to wrap our minds around previous lifetimes. But just think of how long it takes to make spiritual progress and to get to that place for each of us, wherever we are, where we actually want to rid ourselves of delusion, where we're actually willing to take the steps that would be necessary to begin to do that, to even begin to notice when we don't. When Davy Novak was giving a talk, again up at SRW, she told this beautiful story, speaking to how hard this is, even for somebody, she's lived in Ananda for 40 years, more than 40 years now, I'm sure. I don't, whatever it is, 40, 45. She said one day she had done a seclusion retreat down in Encinitas at the Self-Realization Fellowship, where Yogananda had meditated for years, where he gave Sunday service. One can imagine that the vibration is very expansive there, very high, we say, very pure. And she was in a very deeply centered, attuned to those vibrations place. And she said she walked out to the ocean one night after her meditation, just as the sun was setting. The Hermitage sits right on a cliff, right on the ocean. And she said the sunset was so beautiful, all she could see was Divine Mother in these exquisite flowing robes. That's what was there before her. She was meditating not just on Divine Mother, but with Divine Mother. And then she said, somehow, out of the corner of my eye, I caught this little darkness in the ocean. And suddenly I needed to know what they were. And I looked and I realized, oh, they're four surfers. And so I started following the surfers. And she said, before I knew it, 30 minutes had gone by, and all I had thought about is he going to fall? Is that one going to fall? How long can they stay up? She said, from this extraordinary place of inspiration, just that quickly. And of course, it happens to all of us. So how is it that we would step back on this path? This is why Patanjali said, and now we come to the study of the science of yoga. People had already expounded on Vedanta, the truth, the absolute of what is. There had already been great works done on Shankhya, which is why we suffer, what takes us off the path. And now the study of yoga. And the study of yoga says, how will I go home? How will I get back? Smriti, it's called. It's into that place of absolutely knowing, because I remember from the inside out, not from the outside in, who I really am. How will I rid myself of all of these egoic attachments? I just had this thought that went through my mind as I'm thinking about what we're asking of ourselves, that Babaji said to Sri Yukteswar, I think it was, if it was one of the other masters, it will hold just as true, was one of these great beings behind me. When Yukteswar was saying to him, why did you leave me? I had you in my sight. Why did you disappear? And he said, the restlessness of your thoughts basically vaporized, that's not the word he used, extinguished me from the ether, the restlessness of your thoughts to one of these masters. So when we think about what we might need to do or want to do, because we're here, because we've been drawn, because our hearts want to be wide open, we want to be receptive, we want to begin to attune ourselves to the only truth there is, that we are one with God. It's not just that God is acting through us, it's that God is us and we are God. But how do we take those words and give them meaning? And in the end, we know that the study of yoga, not Hatha yoga, not any branch of yoga, but the true meaning of yoga is what it is that will take us there. Patanjali's second aphorism, yoga's citta vritti niroja. Yoga is the neutralization of all of those whirlpools of energy that have us stuck outside of ourselves with our energy flowing out rather than knowing how to draw that energy in and bring it up our spine and continue to allow energy to do practices that have us allowing that energy to flow freely, because in the end, no matter how hard we try, no matter how much reading I wanted to do yesterday about the reading today, no matter how much we study, no matter how many classes we listen to, we cannot solve this problem of soul consciousness from the ego. It's just simply an impossibility. It doesn't mean we don't study. It doesn't mean we don't come to Sunday service. But it means that ultimately, finding a way to take ourselves inside, to remember what home really means, to have that desire be so strong that we keep willing ourselves to put one foot in front of the other foot in front of the other foot. Jaya, who also gave a talk up during this week of SRW, said at some point in his life, he was a very bright man, really very intellectual, and he said, I was a skeptic. I was skeptical of everything. It was like, prove it to me. If you can't prove it to me, I'm not going to let it in. He said, one day, I made one of the most important decisions, not one of, the most important decision at the time that I had ever made. He said, I decided to not disbelieve. What an extraordinary saying that was. I decided to not disbelieve. He opened himself to every possibility. He was called, I don't know by what, I didn't hear his story, how he wound up hearing these teachings, how he wound up even with that desire to know more, that place in us that said, there's got to be more than how I'm living. There's got to be more than these endless cycles of feeling absolutely great about life, as I did in my 30s. And then suddenly, having everything that you thought was bringing you all of that joy whisked away in one form or another. Very hard to remember when everything's going well. And I imagine there are not all that many people right here today who would even say, you're suffering. We don't use that word lightly. So what is it that draws us in? It's something different for each of us. But it's that willingness to not disbelieve. It's the willingness to keep coming back. It's the willingness to say, maybe there's more. The desire to put a huge amount of energy behind that so that we can moment by moment, day by day, month after month, attune ourselves ever more perfectly to that divine presence within. I think the most profound thing that I heard when I was at SRW, and believe me, please go to ananda.org, click on SRW and listen to these talks if you've not done them. Just do one a day or one or two a week. They're mostly 20 minutes. Some of them are 30. They just change your life because you get to have those moments where you rest in the truth, where you are lifted because you're resting in the truth up out of this egotistical, egocentric, ego-involved self that we all are. They literally help lift us into this kingdom of heaven. What does the kingdom of heaven mean? It means those moments we have where we remember that we are that we are nothing less than a spark of pure divine energy. Devarshi said at the very end of his talk, and it really caught my attention, later, meaning 10 seconds later, it just stopped me psychically in my tracks. He said, do whatever it is you have to do. Don't give up. His two words for his talk were, don't forget and remember. Those were the two lessons that he wanted to send us off with. But he said, if it's as simple as this, if it's taking a chant that you love, that touches you, that beautiful chant that Janice led this morning, I have nothing to offer you, for all things are thine, spoke so directly to that. And then he said, and I thought he was going to say, chant it all day. I even thought, literally before he got his words out, that he might say, chant it all week. But that's not what he said. He said, take that chant and chant it for a year. It was incredible to me that he said that. And he meant it. He was nearly in tears. You'll see when you listen. He was telling us so passionately, just do that. Take a chant and chant it for a year. Make it yours. One chant, if we do one of these beautiful chants that speak the deepest of truths to us, I have nothing to offer you, for all things are thine. And you go on and on with those words. You get that perfect. Then you become blessed in the poor of spirit. And you awaken in the kingdom of heaven.